Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Amarta Bernal and you are listening to A Different Path. Welcome back everyone to another edition of A Different Path, and this episode is a very exciting episode for me as it is a collaboration between myself and the Sunny Empire State College Center for Autism Advocacy, Research, Education, and Supports, and it's also known as CARES. The primary initiative of CARES is to support Sunny Empire State College to become an autistic supportive college using a college-wide universal design approach. The Autistic Supportive College Initiative seeks to increase enrollment, support retention, and improve graduation and post-graduation employment outcomes for autistic and neurodiverse students. CARES commits to be informed by autistic and neurodiverse individuals, caregivers, and relevant parties and research. And it is with that I want to give a big shout out to Dr. Noor Syed and Dr. Laura Allen for partnering with me and introducing me to this amazing autism advocate, Michael Gilbert, who is a special education lawyer in New York. And it is with that I want to thank him for his willingness to contribute to the important conversation surrounding the autistic college and workforce experiences. How are you doing today, Michael?
Good, thanks, Armando. How are you?
I am doing really well. And honestly, I got to say, I have yet to meet any kind of lawyer by any means, much less one that is also on the autism spectrum. That is absolutely incredible.
There are a lot of us out there.
Well, I mean, that's a good thing, right? Just being able to help out so many different types. So we'll go ahead and get started. First off, I'm interested. What made you choose special education as your area of expertise?
Well, I went to law school trying to decide what to do with my life because getting a job was hard. I was at that point in my early to mid-20s. Trying to figure out what do I want to do with the rest of my life. And I realized that one of the challenges I had was being somebody on the spectrum who grew up with not getting the services I needed, that I wasn't given what I should have been given in school. And I wanted to help other children avoid some of those same challenges I went through.
So what do you mean by that? So you weren't originally diagnosed at like 2 or 3, like it was much later in life for you?
I was diagnosed at 18.
Wow. Okay. So did you always feel like there was something that was maybe different or off about you while you were growing up?
I was always told I wasn't going to accomplish anything. When I was a child, the school social worker who's supposed to be the expert told my mother, your son is deeply disturbed. He'll never graduate high school. You know, forget about him, throw him in the garbage. He'll never accomplish anything. And so from there, you know, I obviously proved them wrong. And I went on to go to college, law school, and become an admitted attorney. And it just made me think back about my life and about what could have been and about all the mistakes that were made in the system. And also, I took education law in law school, and it was one of the more interesting classes I took. You know, there were classes you take in law school that you never want to see again. Like after taking one semester of corporations, I was like, yeah, I'm never going to be a corporate lawyer. That's never going to happen. It was one of the most boring classes I've ever taken.
It's honestly refreshing, though, to hear that you have found not only an area of expertise that you enjoy, but also one that's so meaningful and impactful. I mean, just like you, my mother was told by the doctor, hey, you might as well learn, teach him sign language because he's never going to speak. And now here I am hosting a podcast. So,
well, I never had a problem speaking. Like some people on the spectrum, as my mother says, I was pre-verbal. I always had a big mouth. I had a problem with telling teachers when they were wrong. Even in first grade, teachers didn't like hearing from a student in the class, hey, you're wrong. And it was something that ironically, when I was younger, like in first grade, like I said, by the time I got to law school, I learned better not to tell teachers, hey, you're wrong, I know better than you. So the older I got, the better I was about not correcting the teachers, even if I was more knowledgeable as I got older.
Let's back up a little bit, though, because what you're saying is not only something that happened to you, but I am sure many people on the autism spectrum has heard it, that they're not going to graduate from high school, they're not going to go to college. What does that do to you? What were you feeling during those times?
It's hard to remember, honestly, because you're talking about, I'm now 44, so you're talking, this was in sixth grade when this guy said this, so you're talking 30 plus years ago. I'm just trying to think what year it would have been approximately, like 32 years ago. So it's really a long time ago, so it's hard to think back that far and to remember.
Yeah, I mean, it was a different time too, I imagine. I mean, I've told in other interviews that I've had is that in the 90s even, autism wasn't really spoken of. It was more shameful to have something that was different of you. And I can't imagine what it was like even further than that.
Well, and I always say that, you know, when I was growing up, autism was a kid sitting in the corner, banging his head against the wall. It wasn't the wide spectrum that we see and understand today.
Did your mother and, you know, father, your family ever feel like there was something that they could put, like, they, did they know that you had autism growing up, or they always had a feeling?
No, they never knew. They didn't figure it, realize it until I was 18.
What was their opinion about it?
They didn't know. My mother just said she knew I didn't belong in some of the schools that the school district was suggesting. And she knew somehow, just instinctively, that the social worker was a jerk, and that he was not doing right. And ironically, about a decade ago, now with internet and Google, you can find anybody. I looked him up to try to get in touch and say, hey, you were wrong. Look at where I am now. Unfortunately, I found his obituary. He had died a few years earlier, cancer. So I didn't get that satisfaction, but such is life.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I think you prove him wrong every day, just being a lawyer, being able to help out so many people.
But part of me wanted him to know.
Yeah. To know, like, hey, you were wrong. You were awful at your job.
Yes. But, yeah. Life goes on, and you know, what are you going to do? He died, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah. You keep living, and you keep moving on and helping so many people.
Exactly. And I think so much of this is about people who misunderstand who are supposedly the expert. And I see it every day in my work. I see school administrators say this child is disturbed. This child's never going to accomplish anything. He's just a bad kid. I had a case recently, and we're having to appeal it, with a kid on the spectrum who has been bullied mercilessly. And the school's position is he should learn to be normal. He brought it on himself. If he would just learn to be normal, he wouldn't be bullied.
What do you say to someone like that?
There's not much you can say. The school district's position has largely been that the bullying, which, first of all, it's not bullying, because he brought it upon himself in their mind. He deserves everything he's getting.
Yeah. And that just really, I imagine, inspires you to keep fighting for all of these people.
Especially in a case like this, where, to put it mildly, the school district attorney is a terrible human being who advocates mm-hmm. against children. And there are school board attorneys who are, I might disagree with them, or they might have to do they're doing their job protecting the school district, which is, again, their job. And I respect that. But this guy goes out of his way to be just a jerk.
And unfortunately, there are those people out there, and you're changing, hopefully, minds every day. Have you seen a lot of people that have changed their mind on what autism is like when they see you and just being as successful as you are?
I hope. I think it depends on the person. I have friends who have had, different conceptions of autism based on me, things they've understood, things they haven't understood, friends who've had to learn about autism from being around me, friends who, I think so many people have so many preconceptions of autism, of what it is and what it's supposed to be, that people really don't get it. Mm-hmm. People say to me sometimes, and I hate this, and it's not her fault, but you're not like Temple Grandin. And they think all autistics have to be like Temple Grandin. And again, Temple Grandin has done a lot mm-hmm. to raise awareness, but this idea that every autistic person must be like Temple Grandin drives me crazy.
I think that's something that, I definitely have related to as well. It's like, well, you don't look autistic, or you're not doing autistic things. And it's like, that doesn't define it.
Right. And I don't know what looking like autistic means. Or people say, but you're so normal seeming.
Yeah.
And I think for those of us who can mask and come off typically, and are in many ways viewed as non-autistically autistic, it's different. People understand some people with autism who appear, quote, unusual or different. But for most of us who know how to blend into society and understand, it's different. And I think what, my friend Stephen Shore, who's very well known in the community, has always said, you met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And I think that's something that people forget. And again, not trying to criticize Temple Grandin, but she's become this template for all autistics, to the point that they think everybody has to be Temple Grandin.
They forget the spectrum portion of autism.
Right. And again, it's not Temple's fault. Temple's done a lot to raise awareness, but they think everybody must be like her.
No, exactly right. And they also don't see the hard work that has been put into blending into society or being able to be a part of it. I mean, with every, perfect conversation that's being done, they aren't seeing the frustration or the repetitive trials that were done previously as they were learning how to have those conversations.
Absolutely.
And it's really interesting how people can just not understand that kind of thing. Would people be surprised that you did have autism though? Or is it people like, oh, okay, yeah.
Some people are. You get the occasional person who will say, you don't seem autistic, or I wouldn't have guessed. And then you have people who are much more attuned, who sometimes spot something different. But I'm very good at blending in and, you know, being. I always say in some ways, I've gotten both flack and praise for an article I wrote a while back in the Autism Spectrum News, which I'm on the editorial board of, which is feeling half autistic, half neurotypical. Like, I'm not quite either, because in many ways I relate more to people who are not autistic on certain things that I don't, where I see people on the spectrum in ways that I don't totally relate to.
Yeah. No. So how does the autistic community accept you as opposed to like the neurotypical community?
I think it depends on our community. The autistic community is so broad. I have friends who are also on the spectrum, mostly who are more typical appearing. And then I have, you know, like any community, there are people I don't like and people who don't like me. You know, there's a couple people in particular in the autism community. One is prominent. He and I do not like each other. And we have clearly a vehement dislike of each other for many reasons.
I mean, unfortunately, that's been something I think has been growing, not just between the autism community, but also like I'm in the ABA field. And I've seen that also where it's a division between, oh, why are you doing ABA? You know, there's all these horror stories, you know, why are you autistic? And off camera, we were talking about that briefly. And it's interesting the dynamics that are starting to be apparent.
Well, and I think it's interesting because to me, you know, you talk about being a BCBA, and I've been meeting more and more autistic BCBAs in the past few months and year or so. And what I find interesting is, you know, I just co-chaired a task force for the Autism Society nationally on ABA, is trying to do a comprehensive paper on ABA and soliciting feedback from stakeholders across the board, parents, self-advocates, professionals. And I was the self-advocate co-chair of their task force. And we had a really comprehensive online town halls with all three communities, self-advocates, parents, and professionals. And we find, you know, there's a variety of opinions on ABA, and it's not as simple good or as ABA is good or ABA is bad. As I always say, it depends. What is the behavior you're trying to address and how are you addressing it? You and I were talking off camera about the legendary, famous Judge Rottenberg Center, which uses electric shock therapy on students. That's not how you address behavior. When you shock a child with, I think it's 7 or 8 times the strength of a police taser, or depriving them dinner or strapping them to a board, this place is well known for being abusive. And that's a whole nother conversation. But the question is always, what kind of behaviors are you trying to eliminate? As I always say, if the behavior is harmful to the child or someone else, that's one thing. If it's not, that's a different. You know, we have kids who will stim in class by flapping their hands or appearing, quote, unusual. Those behaviors don't need to be addressed or eliminated because they're not harming anybody. But I also have kids who run in the street. You can't just say, well, that kid is autistic, let him be who he is. Because if you let him run in the street, you're going to have a dead child. So you obviously have to address that behavior. As I was mentioning to you before, a child I represent who masturbates in class, as she gets older, that's going to be a problem. These are things we just can't have in society, autistic or not. There are certain social norms we all have to adapt to. And I think part of that is the fact that we need to understand that part of it is not eliminating behavior to make, some people view ABA as making the child more typical, making them indistinguishable from a non-autistic. I think it really depends on the behavior. Kids who are running in the street, violent, masturbating, you know, hitting their classmates, stabbing them with pencils. These are behaviors that just we can't accept in society, autistic or not. And so these are behaviors I feel that ABA is appropriate when done properly to address. Again, if the kid is doing something non-dangerous or non-inappropriate, like flapping their hands, it might look unusual, but there's no reason to make the kid tick distinguishable. We all have stims and ticks and whatnot. People bite their nails. I bite my nails. I don't think that's an autism thing. They chew their hair. People, you know, will tap a pencil. We all have things that we do to stim that people do, tapping their foot. But the question is the behavior something that can be allowed? Or again, is it something that has to be eliminated? You know, again, kid running in the street. There's really no margin for error there in my mind.
I mean, and I think that there's a certain level of animosity, like you were saying with ABA in that sense, that there's people like in the Rotenberg Center and other areas that are causing more abusive terms and calling it ABA when that's not true at all. And that's not exactly what the science is. And it's very unfortunate. But what is fortunate is that there's people like you out there. There's people, you know, that any one of my guests that are out there just advocating for autism, advocating for their rights. And that is absolutely incredible to have out there. With that said, so how did autism impact your college experience as you were trying to become a lawyer?
You know, it's funny. When I got to college, it was actually where I felt more at ease and more like I fit in than I did ever before, being in a typical environment. I had trouble making friends in college. I lived at home. A lot of kids lived in the dorms, so that made it hard. But I have some friends I'm still in touch with from college, not that closely, but a couple. And you know, through Facebook, you keep in touch with people from years back. And Facebook is an amazing way to reconnect with people. Social media has a funny way. The world, you know, the world when I was in college, there was no social media in the late 90s to 2000. Now you can find people you knew years ago. So I think that that's a different world too. But as I got to college and law school, I made friends and I, you know, got older. I learned how to become friends with people, as they say, as an adult. My earliest friends are from college or slightly after.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's now it seems like there's larger groups, there's more activities that are being displayed, and there's just more ability to connect with people and more than ways to one than one. With you going from college section, you know, having to just been diagnosed with autism and then going into the workforce, what was that like for you?
It was hard. I mean, look, I don't interview well, and I got to a point where I made a lot of connections through political involvement. And what I realized is most of the jobs I got back then were jobs I got because I knew somebody. And the problem is, I think we as a society place too much on an interview where you get a very snapshot of the person. And I learned that the job world is more about who you know than what you know.
Connections matter. Networking matters. That is for sure.
Exactly. And people have told me I'm a great networker, which has worked to my advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's how you get cases, I imagine. That's how you get known throughout your specialty.
Well, and getting good reputations from parents.
Do you feel like there needs to be any kind of changes either within the workforce or even in the college and faculty that you went through in order to better support those that are neurodiverse?
Absolutely. And I've worked with some schools on that. It's hard because I think a lot of people don't understand fully what neurodiversity is.
Mm-hmm. So what would you describe it as in your own words?
Because I think there needs to be education of college faculty, because I think so many people don't understand so many of these professors, especially those that have been there for 30, 40 years, can be inflexible.
They are. I mean, it's the same mindset we just talked about when, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, nobody talked about autism. Nobody talked about any kind of mental health disorder or any kind of difficulty. It was just put under the rug. And now we're in this new generation where it's a very accepting and very diverse. And it's two different ends of the spectrum in of itself that are meeting together.
Right. And I think part of the problem is people make assumptions, you know, about what autism is. And again, so many professors will say, oh, this, I've done it this way for so many years. If all these other people can do it, so can he.
I think that goes into the phrase of like, oh, we've always done it this way. That's the line that always gets me, is like, that's not the best way. That's not the most perfect way to do anything. You talked about earlier about a training, or like, you know, that faculty or staff or anyone in the workforce and the college area can get some kind of training. What would that look like for you? What could colleges and workforces look for?
Look for people who fit the skill set. You know, I think part of life is also about, as someone on the spectrum, finding the job that's a good fit for you, not necessarily the job that may be your dream. And sometimes dreams change, you know, that we have to understand that job, you know, sometimes what, you know, every kid grows up and has this dream. I'm going to be a president. I'm going to be an astronaut. And you have to be realistic in your dreams.
What was your dream job as a child?
I wasn't sure. When I was 11 or 12, I wanted to play for the Mets before I realized I was completely athletic and uncoordinated.
Yeah.
unathletic and uncoordinated. And it wasn't a realistic dream. I'm overweight and out of shape now, and I'm not somebody who would ever be an athlete. So I think that was a dream that was pretty easily lost eventually.
Yeah, mine was to be a paleontologist, because I had just saw Jurassic Park when I was like 8, and I thought it was the coolest job.
Right, but that's more realistic probably.
Yeah. Yeah, after I realized that I don't get to play with the real dinosaurs, that was a dream that was short-lived.
Okay, that part I will give you is unrealistic. There weren't really real dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But I think it all depends on, you know, what's realistic. You know, any job, any disability, there's a career path for you. You just have to be realistic.
I think that is where a lot of schools now, at least the ones I've been able to experience, are taking into consideration. It's not so much, oh, you know, they're going to be maybe a lawyer or not. I mean, that's definitely up to the functionality of the child, but it's also, what are their likes? What do they enjoy? Okay, let's see if we can find a career out of something that they enjoy. If they, you know, love space, maybe they work at a museum of science. If they love dinosaurs, maybe they, you know, work there as well. Or maybe they do some kind of career that involves that kind of section.
Right.
So with regards to your career, do you feel like your autism impacts the way that you, one, see a case, but also act on it?
Yeah, I think it does. I think a lot, and I've had parents say to me, I like your perspective because you understand my child in a way that other people do not.
How often do you tell your clients about your story, or do you make it more so about them?
It's very public. It's on my website. I don't hide it. And I have the attitude at this point in my life, if somebody's not going to accept you for being on the spectrum, then they're not somebody you would want anyways. And I think clients who would say, you can't be a lawyer because you're autistic, is somebody who doesn't really understand what autism is.
Did you always maintain this vocalness of your autism? I know, so personally for me, when I was growing up, I was a bit ashamed of it. And my listeners know this. And as I grew more and more, I was like, no, this is me. This is who I am. This matters.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people when we're younger were like, no, I'm not like that. I denied it for a long time until I finally accepted who I am. I think we all go through that at times in our life.
You want to fit in. Nobody that wants to be different, especially, in middle school and high school, it's all about like, oh, being with.
Appearing what I'm quote unquote normal. And what is normal? As I always tell people, there is no normal.
Yeah, I definitely don't know what normal is, that's for sure. What advice would you give employers that are wanting to get more inclusive workforce? I mean, we talked about earlier about how they need to be more flexible. What is there anything that particularly they should look for or do differently in their interview process rather than just a quick snapshot?
I mean, I think just more tolerance, more acceptance, more understanding, accept differences.
How often do you not see people accept these differences?
Very often. I think a lot of people on the spectrum are challenged with employment because, a lot of workplaces assume, you have to fit into a certain box. And very often that box is not something that, people on the spectrum fit in, instead of realizing the value of neurodiversity.
What do you think people need to do differently in order to interact more effectively with people with autism?
Just accept them for who they are. Don't judge them. Don't assume what autism is. Don't presuppose things. Don't think, oh, this person has autism, so he's going to fit into this box.
I think that's something that we can do regardless of if they have autism or not. I know that, like, we've talked about where it's more of a conversation. It's like, but you don't look autistic. Where I was like, why does anyone have to look like anyway? Just accept anyone where they're at and move forward from there. Look at their skills. Look at their mindset and abilities and take them for that.
Right. And what does it mean to look autistic? There is no such thing.
I don't know where that really came from. And it's, I mean, again, it's people like you and it's other autism advocates out there that are really changing that mindset. And I think it's about time that's happened.
Like I told you, when I was growing up, so many kids would say, so many people would thought of autism as a kid sitting in the corner, banging his head against the wall.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've had some patients that I work with and their parents are like, oh, my child's life is over. Oh, they're not going to accomplish anything. Much like what you had here when you were in sixth grade. And it's sad that it's still happening. I mean, in this day and age, but it's also becoming less and less often. Now I'm hearing more parents that are saying, okay, what's next? Or what can I do for my child rather than just accepting that nothing can be done?
I think the parents need to always fight for their children and not realize they're their child's best advocate.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten that question a lot of like, what can I do to support my child during these hard times? It's like, just accept them, just where they're at and move forward from there.
Just because somebody is supposedly an expert and has a degree or a credential in front of their name doesn't mean they know better.
Especially as a parent, you're always going to know your son or daughter more than anyone else.
Exactly. Parents know their children best. And don't just assume because the school tells you. One of the things I do is to educate families on what they're actually entitled to. So many times their families will say to me, well, I just assumed because the school told me.
Yeah. And you have to do your own research. You have to be able to do everything you can for your child.
And then parents find out they're entitled to things that they didn't know they were entitled to.
What advice would you give to parents that just get the diagnosis, their child's 2, 3, maybe even 18. What advice could you give their child to the parent?
Ask questions, challenge.
Challenge who exactly? Doctors, schools, or?
Challenge the schools, the supposed experts.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good advice. And as we said earlier too, you have a relationship and association with CARES. Can you tell us a little bit more about that relationship?
Well, I got connected with Noor Syed, who's that director, and Lauren, who's the assistant director, through my autism networks. I've done a couple of podcasts with them and one of their conferences. I mean, I haven't been up there to visit the program specifically because of the pandemic, But I, you know, that's what I know, is that they're doing a lot to educate colleges on how to be more neurodiverse and inclusive and be a more welcoming environment.
Your ability to be in those conferences, I think our ability to spread good places. It's important that people see that side as well. It's not just one or the other.
Right. And I think that that's part of the issue, is that more schools are developing these neurodiverse initiatives.
And we're seeing it more. And I think that's also why we're seeing not only the acceptance of autism, but also the increased diagnosis. I mean, just recently, the CDC also increased their prevalence of autism. And it seems like it just keeps going up each year.
Every time a year. Well, I think it's that we're getting better diagnostic criteria.
Yes. No, I think so. And I think also people are hearing more about autism and they're like, you know what? That sounds like me. All these things that I'm hearing about, that sounds just like me. And they go and get their diagnosis and they're like, yeah, and they get the autism diagnosis. I've had other guests on the show and they're like, "Oh, I was 35. Oh, I was, you know, I was 45 when I got my diagnosis." And it's interesting that for so many people, they're realizing more about themselves that late in the game. And it's how were you feeling when you did get your diagnosis at 18? Did you realize like, "Oh, no, this is me?"
I don't remember actually. I don't specifically remember.
Yeah, I got mine when I was small, so I was a toddler. So obviously I don't remember, but it's been nice after my parents told me about it to realize like, "No, this is who I am." And it's been more of a relief than anything else to really accept it.
And I think like you're saying about how the diagnostic the incidence of prevalence is going up, I think part of it is better diagnostic criteria, to the point that it's almost like we're going to end up in a place where autism is not unusual or neurodiverse, but half the population is going to be considered autistic.
The way the tables turn, that's for sure. That's interesting.
Right. And I think it is. And I, like I've always said, males and females, it's a very interesting thing because it's always been thought of as a male disability. And it's really taken us a long time to see more and more females getting diagnosed, because females are notoriously underdiagnosed.
Yeah. I mean, that is just education in the works right there.
Well, part of it is they say males are more aggressive, more in your face, mm-hmm. while females are more, quote unquote, under the radar. Yeah.
But that also means that they're not getting the services that they need, which is very unfortunate.
Right. It's a, you know, there's this idea of what is a male way to be autistic? What is a female way to be autistic?
Do you find that you're getting a lot of cases with females that have special disability needs, or is it mostly males?
I'd say it's about a 50-50 split, maybe a little more male, but mm-hmm. not markedly so.
It shouldn't matter, I think, like you said. I think it's just a matter of like, this person needs help. This is what I'm doing, everything I can. And it's nice to know. So how prevalent would be a special education lawyer? Is there a high need for that? Are you like one in a million or?
Absolutely. I think most children who are in special ed often need a lawyer. A lot of kids who need services are not given IEPs. A lot of kids do not get identified properly, and it's what's called child find. School has an obligation to identify children with disabilities, but schools will often say, oh, the kid doesn't actually need services, and they'll miss it. What I specialize a lot in is schools are very more adept at knowing if the child has academic deficits, but if the child has social emotional needs, but is getting good grades, they ignore that.
For those parents and those with autism going through it all, like what advice would you give them getting through, you know, high school, middle school, college? What can they do when they're trying to consider college?
Ask questions, challenge, ask what they can do for neurodiverse individuals. You know, look for a college that has an autism support program.
What about what about advice for those that are in college? Maybe the not so much the faculty and staff, but the newer typical people that are interacting with those that are neurodiverse.
Accept them. Just, you know, don't treat them as weird. Don't bully them. Don't make people feel unwanted. I think too often, you know, college is about fitting in and being part of a clique, and that's part of the problem.
But I mean, as we're getting more and more people that are neurodiverse in college, I mean, I know that it used to be a higher percentage of people dropping out of college, and that's starting to get less and less. Like, it's great to see that there's not only more of an awareness, but also that acceptance piece too.
Right. And I think too many people assume, you know, this idea that if you're on the spectrum, you know, you're not going to be able to go to college or do certain things with your life that are just not the fact.
Michael, where can people reach you if they had any more questions or they wanted to provide you with their business as well?
Sure. My best way is through my website, which is www.michaelgilbergesq.com. Again, MichaelGilbergesq.com. And I can be reached at michaelgilbertesq, same thing, at gmail.com.
I mean, with all that said, I think that this has all been absolutely wonderful to get, you know, all these questions out there, making sure that people understand that there are different like choices and options of what they can work for. There's different centers. There's the CARE Center that's been incredible. And that brought us together as well for this interview.
I meet people all over in the community. As I said, I know a lot of self-advocates within the autism world.
I love that. And with that said too, I mean, there's so many different people that are listening that have, you know, questions and just have a number of things that they want to do. I mean, there's some people still with autism that may feel alone with their diagnosis. Is there any kind of advice that you can give those with autism that may be listening right now?
Reach out, look for help. There's always resources out there. In many ways, it sounds a little weird to say, but Google is your friend. If you Google, you will find something. There's always a group. There's support groups, there's networks, there's local autism organizations. There's so many autism organizations all over the country that, you know, it's hard to keep up with everything.
You know what, Michael, with that all being said, I just want to say thank you for your time. I really appreciate this. And I know a lot of people are really going to benefit from this.
I certainly hope so, because I, you know, my goal has always been to help others on the spectrum.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show this month. Thank you everyone for listening. Please be sure to like us on Facebook and Instagram at AutismINDL. And if you like what you heard, please be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, I am Armando Bernal, and I hope to see you again when we travel down a different path.